This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This work, it's caught between two worlds. A very strong, dynamic, vibrant community of people engaged with and fighting the ongoing situation that we might say, the ongoing crisis that is asbestos in the built environment, who might see work like this as being somewhat dilettantish, maybe a little too intellectual, maybe a little too vague when the problem is so clear. On the other hand, there's a sense in which literary scholars might also think, well, why are you doing this type of work when, in a sense, there are urgent questions in literary studies that are maybe more focused on what is happening within literary studies? What does this do for literary studies? And I'd like to say that I'll answer that this evening, but I probably won't. What I do want to say is, rather than give some clarion call to arms, much as I would like to be the person who could do that, is I'd like to use this maybe 1 minute to explain why I do this work. Because I find that when you talk to people who are affected by asbestos because their families have dealt with the diseases, because their houses have it nestled in the infrastructure, because they have school meetings where they talk to principals who have to disclose that there's asbestos in their school, in their hospital. One of the things that makes for a credential is the ability to say that you have a connection. And my connection is that my grandfather was the mine manager of one of the largest blue asbestos mines in Southern Africa, and my father grew up on that mine. And so in some ways, my father's stories about growing up on that mine inform the work that I do. This strange combination of, you know, horror, terror, disgust at what the industries were doing, combined with a kind of nostalgia for a time growing up, right? And in brief, before I start the actual presentation, I would like to make it some sort of nod to the fact that that kind of work, one of the things that really was a compelling influence on me coming to visit you all in Philadelphia was this very successful project here, Reach Ambler, that was run by Fran Barg and Edward Emmett, but also was very much in collaboration and communication with communities here. If you're not familiar with that project, I really recommend you Google Reach Ambler and look at some of the documentation, because when you look at the cultural resources that that project produced, what you find is that these stories come up. This strange combination of needing to talk about the past because it's an urgent matter for the present, but also not wishing to give up on the complexities of that past. So, I mean, that's my kind of attempt at a bit of a shout out. I'm going to now talk for maybe 30 minutes or so on the question of what I'm basically call asbestos in modernism, and we'll kind of get to the end of the talk, and I'll try to flag up some of the political situations that we're dealing with. Because I'm a literary scholar, most of this is going to be about language. Thank you for this kind invitation to talk to you this evening. This presentation brings together various strands of my current work on the matter of asbestos, fibrous silicate substance that, in addition to being a significant feature of 20th century modernity, causes horrible terminal illness. I'll start by thinking about asbestos as a matter of time, The tragic historical pun that develops on time informs the cultural reception of asbestos, a reception that I'll go on to track in modernist literature. Finally, I'll try to assess the impact of this in the present, not as it might seem at first, the clearest example, its ongoing inhabitation of our built environments, our schools, our hospitals and homes, though of course this is where the work becomes most urgent, but in the way that asbestos persists as a point of departure for thinking about contemporary risk, a metaphor whose multiple, often contradictory targets often fail because their source, an implicit history of asbestos, is a history of ambiguity, of cover-up and doubt. To think about this metaphoric instability more concretely, though, through an example, I want to turn our attention briefly to a 1959 film called Asbestos, A Matter of Time.
About a billion years or so ago, when time was young, our Earth was a lonely, barren world. Nothing grew on the land. Few things grew in the sea. No bird song broke the stillness. The wind cried. The storm spoke. And within the earth, violent forces were at work, contesting, molding, preparing for time to come. Beneath the earth's thin, constantly changing crust, molten rock flowed and burned under tremendous heat and pressure, striving to find release. When the crust was torn by subterranean upheaval, molten rock spewed upward. In time, millions of years of time, the molten rock in these crevasses cooled and hardened. Then the hardened rock itself was beset by further disturbances that often left it heavily fissured. Theory says that through these fissures flowed hot, mineral-bearing waters and gases, and as the Earth spun off more millions of years, they crystallized, and in so doing, form the most unusual and useful mineral fiber known to man. Largely unseen, seldom recognized, it has played a tremendously important role in the improvement of our standard of living. As you might expect, the Greeks had a name for it. They called it the unquenchable, indestructible stone. They called it asbestos. Unaffected by fire,
released by the U.S. Chamber of Mines in collaboration with the largest U.S. producer of asbestos, Johns Manville, the film propagates asbestos's truly impressive qualities as a fire retardant and an insulator. Of course, we look back on this film with different eyes. The original Matter of Time, meant to indicate the inevitable progress of industry and enlightenment supported by the miraculous properties of asbestos, has developed a disturbing historical irony. Death after asbestos exposure is presented as if it too were only a matter of time. Asbestos-related diseases, pleural plaques, asbestosis, lung cancer, and mesothelioma are devastating, and it is perhaps their grim reality that alienates us from the happy optimism of this ever so garish propaganda work. However, in its iteration of a creation myth sequence modified to include asbestos, the film seems to demonstrate a more heightened sensibility to the irony in its title than one might first expect. It is precisely asbestos's relative constancy, its immutability after its formation, that makes it a matter made by time, but also a matter out of time, curiously timeless, even as now it seems begins to seem redundant or obsolete. Like some last laugh on historicism or historical revisionism, asbestos seems to remain an interminable, unmediated real. At the same time, As the film follows, the apparently hard rock turning into cobwebs that themselves deconstruct into finer and finer fibers, it manages to demonstrate just how difficult it is to fix asbestos to one form or shape. What I want to do now is propose some ways in which the cultural historian might catch hold of asbestos through its iteration in objects and texts, and follow its trajectory through modernism and modernism's discontents to point towards how that might speak to contemporary challenges in understanding asbestos's cultural legacy. When thinking about this in relation to modernism, we might recall that it is no longer controversial, if it ever was, to claim that the cultural flourishing of modernism, that is, that period in between approximately 1890 to 1940, depended on the mobilization of new materials. Mimi Scheller's Aluminum Dreams, for instance, shows how the dreams of light or fast modernism depended on buildings and vehicles made from aluminum. David Trotter develops similar histories for bakelite, celluloid, and vulcanized rubber as material mediators that afforded new ways of encountering the world. Moreover, scholars are increasingly attending to the unforeseen toxic legacies of these substances and their production lines. Scheller, for instance, is scrupulous in describing the life cycle of aluminum, which, when processed from bauxite, leaves a harmful byproduct called red mud, and releases harmful hydrofluorocarbons into the atmosphere. Alongside the other new modernisms, then, we might well add Scheller's own toxic modernism, a term I'd like to expand to include all those lingering effects of toxicity bound up in modernism's materials and their impact across various iterations of a global modernity. One such material is asbestos, a substance Bruno Latour has evocatively, if confusingly, called the last modernist object. Asbestos lodges itself within modernism in three interlocking ways. First, in its material engagement with one of the four classical elements, fire. Second, in its assuming the status of an element itself, both in the built environment, as its use became habituated, then legislated, and in the affective environment, as its protection from fire extended to anxieties generated by fire. And third, in its inscription as a quasi-theological element of modernist texts. Asbestos, as I said before, is a particularly effective fire retardant, as Rachel Maines has demonstrated in Asbestos and Fire. Asbestos use increased in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in response to increased anxieties about large-scale urban fires. Even the most superficial survey of contemporary magazines, whether cultural, contemporary in the modernist period, I mean, whether cultural like McClure's or Scribner's or scientific like Popular Mechanics, will show increasing numbers of advertisements by asbestos companies for asbestos products to fill the quote-unquote, home of the future, whether these be heating pads, stove protections, roofing materials, or other features of domestic life. These products appear at most in one or two advertisements per issue of McClure's and Scribner's, but they, like a host of other products at the time, emphasize the importance placed in substances that were fireproof. Asbestos use offered an emancipation from fears associated with fire by presenting itself as an insulation from elementality itself, from anxieties about our imbrication or enmeshment in a world all too likely to catch fire. In the present, asbestos is obviously best known for the diseases it causes, sometimes after the briefest of exposures. When asbestos is inhaled or ingested, it often lodges in the cell wall, where it may scar the tissue, leading to asbestosis, or develop into cancers, whether lung cancer or mesothelioma. In a sense, then, asbestos presents that fabulous dissonance that Latour would diagnose in modernism more generally, between what modernists say, quote-unquote, emancipation from all attachments, and what they do, which is create ever more attachments. Modernism, in Latour's reading, claims to attenuate the conditions of risk while embroiling its subjects the more squarely within them. Building on Stacia Limo's work on intercorporeality, Sasha Litvinceva has considered how the cellular interactivity of asbestos might show how such entangled exposures can be figured through a haptic framework. That is to say, it's all about touch. But if touch is, as Litvinceva argues, a useful way into thinking about the workings of asbestos as a toxicant, so something that touches you either through internally through your lungs or externally as you touch it, it risks eliding the crucial role asbestos played in modernism before its effects were more fully known. While the story of asbestos's ever more attachments is relatively well known then, the proliferation of its emancipatory claims in literary modernism is less so. Latour's dissonance in the sense provides a useful starting point for reflecting on the elemental role asbestos played in modernism, in its resistance to the estrangement from materiality, the reduction into mere utility, known as resourcism. And I think that this is one of the things that we need to factor in when we're thinking about how we respond to asbestos in the present, is why it still has this after effect or after image of its profound, the profound significance or importance that people placed in it at about 100 years ago. Much of what follows turns on asbestos's utility as an insulator. Insulation describes a substance with the ability to stop the transmission of sound, heat, or electricity. In the case of asbestos, these material qualities coalesced to create a psychic freedom from anxiety, or in Latour's words, an emancipation from attachments, both material and psychic. But the very qualities that make asbestos a good insulator, resistant to fire, water, acid, damage, and creep, and very relatively cheap to mine and manufacture, allowed asbestos to become an elemental part of urban life, i.e. to create ever more attachments. Certainly, it was rapidly absorbed as a new element in the built environment. For the modernist artist, though, perhaps the most visible example of this absorption was the asbestos curtain. In 1897, Edwin O. Sachs documented more than 10,000 deaths by theatre fires worldwide between 1797 and 1897, largely as a result of stage fires, which were caused by lighting requirements that then spread to the auditorium. There was, therefore, a pressing need for a non-flammable barrier that could divide the two, the asbestos curtain, which separated the theatre's audience from the stage. Here you've got some a scene that I'll come to later, but here's some asbestos fabric that appears in Buster Keaton's 1922 film, The Pale Face. Though presented in a number of different materials, by 1909, legislation in most U.S. cities mandated that this curtain had to be made from asbestos. Its prosaic importance is best measured in the givenness with which it intrudes on modernist texts. Juno Barnes, for instance, in an interview with the fireman Michael Quinn, imagines him spending his evenings, quote-unquote, supervising the rising of the asbestos curtain of the last act. As befits the vox pop profile nature of the piece, Barnes marginalizes the excitement of the theatrical production to emphasize the necessary repetitive functionalism of Quinn's work as a fire warden, overseeing the curtain as a feature of fire safety. As I go on to show, there are other more metaphoric uses of the asbestos curtain in modernist writing, but Barnes's actual curtain serves to remind us of cultural modernism's reliance on emerging forms of materiality, and that the sources of these metaphors were real objects whose initial phase of marvel were quickly dampened by the expectations of habit. In modernist literature, most metaphoric asbestos curtains target associations with the beginning and end of performances. E. Cummings uses the asbestos curtain to uncover precisely something that is meant to be covered up in his memoir, The Enormous Room, from 1922. Cummings discreetly turns his gaze away from the sexual exploits of his fellow prisoners by invoking this physical feature of the theater. Quote, "Now let the curtain fall and the reader be satisfied with the significant word asbestos, which is part of all first-rate performances. Ostensibly a factual account of Cummings's internment at La Ferté-Macé in 1917 for anti-war behavior, contemporary reviewers qualified their praise for The Enormous Room by regretting, quote, its crudities. Michael North notes in Reading 1922 that the memoir presented a calculated indecency that might be seen to be a feature of modernist texts more generally. Drawing down the asbestos curtain, then, signals a metaphoric self-censorship. In a text, however, that, as Hazel Hutherson has argued, presents the struggle for self-expression and freedom of conscience as the real war within the war, both curtain and signal become part of a performance, a wink acknowledging that activities have been covered over, which should have been eliminated entirely. For Cummings, the asbestos curtain presented the distinction between what one can say and what one can't in order to highlight the latter, whereas for others like H.D., Hilda Doolittle, and Elizabeth Bowen, it accompanied a language of theatrical act that both writers draw on to describe different stages in their lives. In Advent, H.D.'s journal of her analysis with Freud, she recalls a combination of traumas that included her father's death, her pneumonia, her delivery of her first child, and the subsequent rejection of the child by Richard Aldington, her estranged husband, in May 1919. The resulting, quote, psychic death is imagined as a, quote, asbestos curtain that had dropped between me and my past, my not-so-far-past bitter severance from love and friendship. The transition signified by the asbestos curtain severed Doolittle from her past, where the curtain becomes a death in life, simultaneously part of the life, but not of it. It presents another moment of severance in Elizabeth Bowen's final novel, Eva Trout, or Changing Scenes, from 1968. Where it signals the end of Eva's time at the experimentary Castle School after her roommate Elsinore's attempted suicide. Quote, with the coming into the room of Elsinore's mother, all here ended. From that instant, down came oblivion, asbestos curtain. Whether Elsinore died or lived, no one told Eva. Again, the asbestos curtain announces a moment of transition. Here, however, it senses what the baffled and inarticulate Eva knows or knows to ask, peremptorily foreclosing both the narrative about the school experience and any questions it might have caused. In each example, the asbestos curtain functions as a cordon sanitaire, separating the consequences of events in the narrative from their prosaic narration. But it does not simply function as a liminal marker, it also discloses the same occlusions that it is meant to obstruct from view. Historically, the asbestos curtain offered modernist writers a metaphoric source that allowed them to draw moral and temporal lines, while also performing this drawing of lines, a self-reflexive gesture that incorporated the physical signifier that began and ended performance as part of all first-rate performances. Given that formalism demands devices, including established metaphoric figurations, the different permutations of the asbestos curtain mentioned above serve as fitting examples of a material object absorbed into a cultural imaginary. Writing long after modernism, the poet, Adrian Rich, would consider how such formal devices might be understood as protections when writing about things that might be otherwise deemed unacceptable. Quote, in those years, formalism was part of the strategy. Like a pair of asbestos gloves, it allowed me to handle materials I couldn't pick up barehanded. Rich's comment suggests that formalism offers a mode of protection for writers. However, it also sheds light on asbestos's other associations, including those of insulation. Rich insists that the insulations of form helped her to develop her style, since she raises it through the domestic image of oven gloves. Readings of the phrase have tended to focus on it as an emancipatory reimagining of the domestic, as a site of potential political intervention, whereby form provides a stepping stone for marginalized artists as they discover their own voice. We can find in Richard's statement an older attitude to asbestos than that disclosed by Litvinceva, who, you might recall, addressed asbestos as different modes of touching. This older attitude relies on understanding asbestos as a material that insulated or protected people from touching. More importantly, it depends precisely on reliance, the unconscious expectation that certain structures will just work, which in itself is exposed as a quasi-theological belief. And here we're starting to see this maybe irrelevant discussion of modernist texts come into our own expectations about our built environment. Our built environment is, we apprehend, a matter of reliance. We rely on things to work. And asbestos, when we see it now, seems to obtrude like some horrific other, some real obtrude into our functioning in the world as something that we can rely on, if that makes sense. Assuming this nascent theology holds, Latour might better frame asbestos as an object that had never been modern at all. For all the scientific associations asbestos advertising sought to create in Popular Mechanics and other popular science magazines, references to the substance still evoked a pre-modern faith-based credence. Audiences watching Buster Keaton's 1922 film, The Pale Face, could laugh when the stoic Keaton, kitted out in asbestos underwear, survives an attempt to burn him at the stake, engendering feelings of shock and awe on the part of his Native American captors. If we bracket for a moment the problems, and there are significant problems, with this further example of the long history of Native American marginality on the silver screen, we might find buried in the audience's laughter the gullibility of subaltern subjects, an unreflecting ignorance about what asbestos really means, a substance that entangles its unwitting users in uncertain histories, where a fiber inhaled or ingested may or may not translate into illness decades after exposure occurs. What is shared from the theology of the pale face to the mundane oscillations of Barnes's curtain is the belief, hope even, that asbestos will protect them from touch, whether of hell, fire, or time. Toxic legacy attests to the failure of that hope. So I'm just going to pass a few kind of comments about where we find what kind of metaphoric work I've tried to do here in the present and why that work in the past might actually still be significant to the present. If we are caught then in multiple possible meanings of asbestos, not just as we receive it in the present, but in how we receive it in texts from the past, I'd like to end by thinking a little bit of how the asbestos metaphor has proliferated more recently. In 2012, the speculative fiction writer Neal Stephenson coined the word has suddenly gone out of my head. When you get two words together and you join them together, I ask for the Joycean's support with this portmanteau. Coined asbestos to describe the public health crisis related to sitting down. Scientific research, Stevenson writes, now reveals that sitting all day isn't just a little bit unhealthy, it's seriously and actively bad for you. Ergonomic swivel chairs, it turns out, are the next asbestos. Apart from the neologism, portmanteau, that he uses in its title, this is the only mention or reference to asbestos in his essay, an indicator that, for Stevenson at least, the public health effects of asbestos are sufficiently well known that their mere mention triggers the cascade of associations necessary for his title to be understood. If the target of Stevenson's metaphor, the hidden epidemic of sedentary state health concerns, should persuade us to reappraise chair-bound work habits, we are, of course, a little more interested at the moment in the source he uses, the next asbestos. Metaphors that rely on asbestos are by no means infrequent now. The next asbestos has been used to describe carbon nanotubes, glyphosate, opioids, talc, and AI in healthcare, just to mention the few that I decided to Google for the purposes of this talk. I didn't get past the top 10. Carry on with this Google project if you would like. Sometimes these associations are invoked to warn people about public health issues, as in Stevenson's essay. Often they appear on investment sites or legal opinion pieces for more cynical reasons. Asbestos tort is a multi-billion dollar industry that has been damaging for the insurance industry and lucrative for specialist lawyers. Indeed, a measure of the success was brought to my attention at a recent conference when a colleague mentioned that he came from Baltimore, where Peter Angelos used his windfall from his work as an asbestos litigator to buy the Baltimore Orioles. In this context, the next asbestos refers to the next major area of litigation, a trope we can see repeated and perhaps reinforced by the irv of John Grisham. Since the previous asbestos was also provided significant financial rewards at the expense of people's health, we might take the next asbestos to signify financial gain at the cost of public health. Asbestos was open to this wave of litigation in part because manufacturers of asbestos products were at pains to dissimulate, obfuscate, or mitigate health information about asbestos reaching a larger public, which means the next asbestos might also signify the further breakdown in public trust when supposedly impartial experts turn out to be partisan. While the reference for the next asbestos diverge across these examples, the phrase maintains a rhetorical consistency, in part reinforced by a collective sense of what asbestos is and what it does, specifically through its connotations of an ongoing, unanticipated public health crisis. This cultural unity means that it can be usefully mobilized for different purposes. The cost of this mobilization is, of course, a sedimentation of an impression that we know what asbestos means, while bypassing any discussion thereof. Historically, as this paper has discussed, asbestos has been associated with two contradictory crises. Originally, it proliferated through the built environment to prevent the rapid spread of fire. Subsequently, as its horrific terminal illnesses became better known, its role in causing crises displaced its earlier function as a crisis preventer. Depending on how asbestos is mediated, one or other of these crises might be the actual referent under discussion. The next asbestos, written at another moment in history, might mean the miraculous solution to an existing crisis rather than the cause of a new one. This recasting demonstrates how important context and audience are when referring to the asbestos crisis, or indeed thinking about how asbestos engages our thinking on time. By way of a coda, to draw my time to a close, I'd just like to draw your attention to this, to an image. Don't have the image here. Unfortunately, it was circulated in July last year of the 45th President of the United States, stamped onto stacks of asbestos products in the Urals in Russia. The image, which was distributed by a Russian company, Ural Asbest, which later admitted that it was just a publicity stunt, depends on understanding Trump's ongoing support for and belief in asbestos, which can be traced back to a passage in his 1997 book, The Art of the Comeback, where Trump praises the substance and decries its regulation as the result of great pressure put on politicians by the mob. A further instance of Trump's trademark rhetorical strategies, vague innuendo combined or compounded by bare, unsubstantiated assertion. This positive regard might have had something to do with an ongoing court case at the time, settled and sealed in 1999, wherein Trump's representatives were sued for damages by poor, undocumented migrant workers who Trump employed in 1979-1980 illegally and at half the union wage to demolish the Bonwit Teller building, now the site of Trump Tower. Their claim was made on the basis that they weren't given hard hats or respiratory equipment, nor were they told about the asbestos that it was their responsibility to extract without protection. I can't say for certain that there was any link between these two asbestos moments in Trump's past, but I'd be grateful for any questions you might have for me now. Thank you.